All right, I taped the podcast with Kevin McHale, which is a big deal for me. If you guys listen to the show at all, you know I grew up loving the Celtics in the 80s, so this isn't quite Larry Bird, but it's about as close as I'm going to get. Going to talk to Kevin McHale for 40 minutes. It was pretty good. We were kind of running against the clock a little bit, so I felt a little rushed, but he did a pretty good job. We have an intro, though. I have two special guests before Kevin McHale, even bigger guests than Kevin McHale, Harry Minahan and Kate Minahan, who I had to drag in here to tape this. I'm on Dabby duty today. What's going on?
Not much.
No.
So, you see Ken here, the producer of my show?
Yeah.
Yep.
He had a thing, he wanted me and Mr. Callahan to talk about the things we don't like about each other a couple of weeks ago. It didn't work out that well, because we get along so well. But I was wondering if you two, because you've been, hanging around each other for the last week, going a little stir crazy. I'll start with Harry. Harry, what is driving you crazy about Kate right now? Go ahead.
When she's being funny.
That drives you crazy?
Yep.
You get mad at her ever?
Sometimes.
But you get along okay with her?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You had more problems. You were driving in. You had a big problem with her. You said she was being rude. What happened?
I don't know.
Okay, good. Solid. Kate, what's your problems with Harry?
He always is breaking some of my things.
Yeah.
And Kate is always trying to copy me or build whatever I am.
Right. And we have the big news that we're going to break on the Enough About Me podcast. We've decided to do it here. Harry Minahan has a girlfriend, right, Kate?
Yep.
Is that right, Harry?
Yep.
What's her name?
Lizzie.
Are you going to marry her?
No.
No, but you do love her?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's all.
I wonder if mommy's watching us.
She's probably going to hear you a lot. Maybe grandma will hear you, too. I expected a little more anger. There's a little more anger between you two driving in here. I thought you guys have a good fight.
Come on, what's that statue behind you of?
I don't know what that statue is. Anything else, Kate, you have to say?
Not much.
No? Harry, but, anything else you want to say?
Oh,
good. Harry, wait one second.
But Daddy said if we move to Maine, he'll buy me a horse.
That's true. If we move to Maine, I would buy you a horse because I do want to live in Maine. I'm sick of living in Massachusetts. Harry, you want to live in Maine?
Oh, yes.
How come?
Because it's fun.
What shoes do you have on right now?
Messi.
Messi shoes? Yep. What number is Messi?
10 Barcelona.
10 for Barcelona. And that's how you feel about Messi is how I felt about Larry Bird and Kevin McHale growing up. So I talked to Mr. McHale today on the podcast. He was one of my heroes growing up. Is that fascinating?
Yeah.
You can listen to the podcast?
Yeah.
You can listen to the podcast, Kate?
Maybe.
You don't listen to it ever, right? Do you listen to the show at all?
Well, I have podcasts on my phone.
I never listen to your show.
iTouch, whatever.
You never listen to the show?
But I sometimes watch you on TV.
Oh, Mr. Tangway?
Yeah.
What do you think of that show?
Good.
Yeah. And Mr. Rob is here today, your godfather. He set you guys up with some TV?
Yep.
Excellent.
Yep.
Excellent. So it's Kevin McHale and Daddy on the podcast. And usually, sometimes I'll do this with Ben, my producer for this show. But you guys are filling in as my co-host leading into today. Anything else before we go?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Kate?
Maybe.
No, any other thoughts, I'm saying.
I know.
Yeah, right.
Harry, Rogue One, good or bad?
Bad.
What?
It was good, but like...
No, like a lot of people died.
That's true.
Yeah, the whole team died.
That's true. If you're in your car right now, sorry about that. If you listen to the podcast, everybody dies, right, Harry?
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry, peoples. We don't mean to spoil anything.
Sorry, peoples. I hope you build Rogue 2 better.
On that note, we will begin the podcast with Kevin McHale of Turner Sports, who is kind enough to come on to talk about, we're taping this Thursday, Thursday's Cavaliers-Celtics game. It's on
the 29th.
I know, what day of the week, I'm saying.
Oh.
Celtics-Cavaliers tonight.
You big Harry.
Yep. You a big Celtics fan, Harry, or no?
Yeah.
Who's your favorite player in the Celtics?
Larry Bird.
Exactly right. Who's your favorite player in the Patriots?
Tom Brady.
Edelman and Tom Brady.
Excellent. So Kevin McHale of Turner Sports, I told him I think he's the best power forward who ever lived, best defensive and offensive combination, didn't have the longest career, but was the best, and by far the most post-up player of all time. My second favorite Celtic growing up.
Harry!
Joins me on the Enough About Me podcast.
Harry!
Harry!
Bye!
The This is pretty exciting, I think, for both of us, because Kevin McHale is the greatest low post player in basketball history. And growing up in Winchester, Massachusetts, in the 80s, I was the best 5'4" post player, Kevin, in Winchester. It was unbelievable. I had the drop step, I had the fadeaway, I had the up and under, I had it all. That's one thing I always say growing up here. You know, like I said, I was in the 80s, I was, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. If you went and watched like a youth game, basketball, it was Winchester, Lexington, any town, you saw a bunch of kids trying to do what you did, posting up, and you saw a bunch of kids trying to shoot left-handed like Bird did. So it was some weird basketball if you watched it.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't recommend that for 8, 9 years old. Yeah, that's a little more advanced. I think they got to wait till they get into high school to do that, but especially the left-handed shooting like Larry.
Did you your post play was so different, and you know, I would say for me, the three best post players I've ever seen are you, Olajuwon, and Duncan. But I put you first. How did you learn that? Where did you watch that growing up? Or was that something that just sort of you found on your own?
Well, you know, my coaches, we had a lot of just very basic stuff, a lot of pivoting, a lot of, you know, getting the ball and staying low and pivot off your left foot, pivot off your right foot. And it was pivot, 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 shot, pivot, 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 pass. And so I was smaller back then when I first started playing. I grew a little bit later. So I played against a lot of bigger guys, and I had to learn how to get up, you know, under them, you know, try to trick them a little bit. And it all really came off the ability to stay low and pivot and have balance. And so I kind of just developed a lot of that stuff, you know, growing up against bigger guys, and then started doing, you know, more of it in college. I played against a, you know, different level of person. Then you got in the NBA, it was the same thing. You had to trick some people. You had to go up over people. So you know, I really did a lot more of it in the pros. In the college, I was, you know, being the biggest guy, you just shoot over the top of them. But in the pros, when you play against guys that are like size or bigger than you, you know, you've got to be able to have some moves and do some stuff. And so it just kind of evolved over the years. But started when I was a young kid.
Did you when you watched, you know, you coached in the league, you're an executive in the league, when you watched over the last 15, 20, 25 years since you've retired, I mean, there must be some guys you've watched over the last that quarter century, and you must say, this guy is this talent, this guy is this. If I could work with him for a day, if I could work with him for a week, he'd be that much better. I mean, there must be guys you watch right now and say, you know, can't you just learn two or three simple post-up moves?
Yeah, really, learn how to attack and get a shot off. You know, going right, and learn how to attack and get a shot off going left. I mean, that's really as simple as it comes to, you know, when you get down the post, you've got to be able to get down there, you know, get your back to the basket and be able to go over your left shoulder, your right shoulder off of one dribble, but you've got to be able to go somewhere with that one dribble. So I look at that right now, and there's very few guys that even go down there to even play down there anymore. The game's evolved so much, and everybody's a stretch four, everybody's shooting from the outside, you know, playmaking from the top of the key. If you're a big guy, it's huge now. I think that's one of the things that the Celtics are going to start playing better. You know, they need to have all their big guys up there, being, you know, Horford and, you know, Linick, those guys making plays from the top. That's a huge part of today's games. Whereas when I played, a big part of the game was who could dominate the paint low by the basket. You know, who could be the most effective team, jamming it inside, getting those tough inside points. You know, being rebounding the ball, blocking shots, protecting the rim. But the game has changed now. You know, the team that leads the league in shot blocking is Golden State.
Right.
And you look at them, and they play without a center 90% of the time. So the game has really evolved and changed, but I still think there's a spot in the league for you know, getting those points down low, and it slows down the momentum of the other team. I think it'll evolve around again where you'll see some bigs play in the post. But right now, that draw of playing on the perimeter, shooting threes and being a playmaker seems to take all the big guys out of the post.
Well, it's wild. I mean, you look back at the stats, say, you know, like Bird, who I think is, you know, as good a shooter as anybody in history. You know, in a big year for him, you know, he might take 100 threes or 120 threes. I mean, now, you know, Curry will do that, you know, in 3 weeks.
Yeah, it is amazing. Back then when I first got in the league, the three was only used kind of as a late shot clock. If you were caught out of position, you took a three or more. If you were, the way it was used mostly was late in the game. You know, you're down 9 with a minute and a half to go. You say, okay, we got to take some threes. But you didn't take them throughout the course of the game. Larry was a great wrist. And so he just flicked the ball. If Larry had played in today's game, I mean, he'd be living out in that three-point line and taking a million of them. But he did, that just wasn't the way the game was played. And so, I agree. It's different. And had Larry and Pete Maravich and some of those other guys that had unbelievable range, use the three-point line like they did today, their stats will look a whole lot different, that's for sure.
You know who was a pretty good three-point shooter at the end of his career? It was Kevin McHale.
Well, I used to shoot a few every once in a while. We'd monkey around in practice and shoot them. And,
yeah, but the last few years, though, you took some last couple of years.
Yeah, I did. I took a few. You know, as you got a little older and beat up,
right.
It's just easier to come down and not go in that post and fight everybody about the whole game. And yeah, I took a few threes once in a while. But again, that was later on in my career, and the 3-point line started becoming a little bit more. Used a little differently back then, but still nothing like it is today. Today's game is completely different, and if I was playing again today, I'd still do the same thing: go down the low post and try to create havoc, try to create double teams, try to get the other team in foul trouble. There's a lot of benefits for getting the ball in the paint, that you don't see in a lot. You'll watch two teams now play, and neither one will be in the penalty
right.
At the end of the quarter. And our big thing was we tried to get in the penalty. It was huge if you could get in the penalty before the 6-minute mark. If you could spend more than half the period in the penalty, it just puts so much pressure on the other team not to foul. It's two free throws every time they touch you. So a different game, but like I said, I enjoy today's game. It's different, but it's fun to watch for me.
And Kevin's here to talk about the Celtics Cavs game tonight, and we'll get to that obviously. But when I have somebody like this, given I'm from here, I grew up here, and the '80s Celtics were my life. It's hard for me not to ask at least a few questions. When you look at the it's the ultimate question. It was debated last year: '86 Celtics versus say the Warriors, or say a team that, like that. For me, for my money, I don't think there's a team in history that would beat that 86 Celtics team at its best. I know you're biased, but I'd be curious what you think on that.
It would be so different. But, we just weren't built to go small like that, and we stayed big and we kept pounding you. It would be, Klay Thompson would be guarding Larry. Believe me, Larry would go in the post steady.
Right.
Draymond Green would be guarding me or Robert. That wouldn't work out well for him. He's just too small. But on the other end, they're going to be shooting threes. It's going to be a different game. But I just think I've often said you're going to have more bad games from 23 feet. Shooting 24 feet, shooting long threes, and those guys they end up shooting some unbelievably long threes than you are from 3 feet. You're going to have a hell of a lot more success from 3 feet than you are from 23 feet over the course of the game. So if we just kept pounding them inside, and the thing I think that everybody forgets is that a lot of that inside action just led to a lot of free throws. And the game gets slowed down, and it gets muddied up. And, any team right now in today's game has a hard time guarding Golden State's three-point barrage shooting that they have. But you're just going to have to keep them in front of you, keep a hand up, and just figure out the odds are that you're just going to keep pounding away. So I think we'd beat them just because I think we were a much stronger rebounding team and a much bigger team. But it would be interesting. It would be really a clash of two styles, that's for sure.
Do you think it's a trap? Like, I feel like as I get older, I do this, and I wonder if the generation before you guys, the Wests and the Russells felt that way. I felt like basketball was better. I felt that the players were tougher. I felt like this. I felt like that. Is that a simple generational trick, or is there some truth in it? Was basketball better 20 or 30 years ago, or is that just me being nostalgic?
Well, I think part of a little bit of nostalgia, and I think a little bit of it is actual. I think that there was more the rules were different. They allowed for more physicality. It allowed you to kind of carve out space more. It allowed you to hold and push a little bit more. It allowed you to put more force on the other people, on the other team, physically wise. Where you don't see a lot of that right now in today's game. But I think. The spacing and the ball movement on the good teams, they're the bad teams, I've always been bad about moving the ball. Guys hold it; it's all one on one. But that was there were bad teams back when I played in the '80s too, that didn't have ball movement. But the good teams really move the ball. The good teams move bodies. There's cutting. There's moving. And when you watch, I watch every once in a while. There'll be someone will put a highlight, send me a highlight film of the you know, 80s Celtics, and just kind of a montage of like the 86 season. It's amazing the amount of ball movement, well, body movement.
Right, the passing was unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It's really, really fun to watch. I see that. I see some of that, you know, when I watch the Spurs when they're really playing well. They move the ball. They pop the ball. You know, Golden State and some of the better teams. You know, the Celtics have a lot of assists now with this team in how they play. And so, you know, I think the best teams have always understood that ball movement, body movement is really hard to guard in our league. And so I think that the ball movement, body movement is, you know, there's always good and bad teams with that. But it was a lot more physical. There's no question. But the rules dictate that. You know, the rules have gotten to the point right now where there's no physicality left in the game.
Well, if you did today, right, what you did to Rambis, you know, in 84, that would be the biggest story in the country for like 3 days. People would be calling for you to be kicked out of the league.
Yeah, no, I know. I didn't even get a technical on that.
You didn't even get a T for it. But, and Parrish did not get it. I don't think Parrish got a technical when he punched Laimbeer in the face, I don't think.
No, Bill had that coming. Even the referees knew that. They went like, go ahead and hit him. You know, but only a couple times. You know, we can't let this get out of hand.
Right.
And then we'll play because no one liked Bill. Even the refs didn't like Bill.
If you walked into a room today, you just walked into a room and you were waiting for an interview or something, and Laimbeer was the other guy in the room, like, would you, if you talked to him, would you talk to him, or do you actually still hate him 30 years later?
I don't really hate him, but no? I don't know if I have much to say to him. I mean, I'm totally ambivalent, you know, right now. A lot of those guys, like Isaiah Thomas and I, were friends, and before, you know, the Detroit Boston kind of, you know, series and mm-hmm. all the fights we had with those guys and stuff. And so I see Isaiah now, and it's good to see him. I always like Joe Dumars, and you know, some of those guys I just don't see, it doesn't bother me not to see Bill Laimbeer. Let me tell you that.
But I mean that rivalry I thought was obviously particularly tense. Probably I would say, but when I look back on it, it's funny growing up. You know, when people say Celtics Lakers, you know, it was a rivalry in the 80s. I understand that it was, no question, with Bird, Magic, and all you guys. But the most intense rivalry that I remember was still the Sixers before, you know, 84, say 81, 82, 83. That always seemed to me to be the most tense.
Yeah, that was the first rivalry I ever got involved in the NBA was the Sixers Celtics, and that was huge. I mean, that was like the year before I got there, the Sixers had beaten them in the conference finals. They wanted revenge. I mean, so I got kind of thrown in the middle of that, and there was a huge rivalry. And back then, there were less teams, and you played the teams in your division six times, and it seemed like you played them all late in the year. So we'd play Philly. Well, first of all, we'd play them in like three or four exhibition games, which is a bad move. Because we kept on everybody, you know, the more you played against each other, the more you disliked each other.
Right.
And then we'd play them a ton in the season, and then we'd play them in the playoffs. And I agree, that to me was my first test, first taste of a NBA rivalry, and that was really, really intense. And then the Lakers-Celtics, you know, but the Lakers-Celtics really kind of started in the Indiana State-Michigan State
right.
game. And you know, that was Larry Magic, mm-hmm. and then you had the league just turning with David Stern, turning the league from, you know, the games in 81, the finals were taped delayed. They started at 11:30
right.
in Boston and 10:30 back in Minnesota, back where I was. My parents, you know, they had to stay up, you know, till 10:30 to start watching the game. And then David Stern's vision of the league, and then Larry and Magic, and then the Lakers and the Celtics. That was all just a huge, great, big, you know, kind of storm of just a lot of stuff stemming from that 79 Indiana State, Michigan State, you know, that which was an amazing, you know, game that so many people watched. And that was really the start of the league. So in my mind, Larry and Magic really kind of resurrected the NBA and turned it into what it is now. They really started that, and the Celtics-Lakers rivalry was huge in that.
You know, I've read a lot, and I've talked to guys like Bob Ryan and Ordway, who I know, about your relationship with Bird, and it always seemed like Bird, the image, the story of it was Bird was a super driven guy, and you were the laid back guy. And I wonder how much truth there is to that. I mean, is that sort of a narrative, a myth, or is there a reality to that?
Well, we were different in some ways, but we were very similar in other ways. You know, Larry and I are still good friends. You know, I mean, Larry was more quiet than I was. I was a little bit. Before the games, Larry had his routine. I had my routine, but you know, they were different. But you know, my routine, I And I never shared it. But and the funny thing, I never shared much of anything that I did, privately with the media. I just kind of had my own little thing. And when after shoot around game days, I would sit there. I'd go through everybody on their team, how they guarded me, how hard to guard them. What were their favorite plays? What they run late? So I had a checklist that I went through my mind all day, the day of games. So when the game started, I had really checked all the boxes and was really ready to go. So I spent hours and hours and hours preparing to play basketball. That was just one of those things. That was just what I did. But Larry did it his way, but he was more quiet, got to the game. But Larry was really a fun guy, and I think that's what everybody forgets. Larry was just really a fun guy to be around. And once you knew him, he was funny, very sarcastic, had a great sense of humor. So as I've told many people, we spent many, many nights sitting around having a few beers, having a lot of laughs. So he was a great teammate, and, he and I are still really good friends to this day.
Does it feel strange to you that neither one of you guys are members of the Celtics organization? That you haven't been, and it's been this. You've been in Houston, you've been in Minnesota, obviously Bird's been in Indiana. Does it feel strange that you've never been, post playing career part of the Celtics organization?
Well, I feel like I'm part of the organization because Danny.
Yeah.
Danny calls me up and he picks my brain all the time, and Danny and I talk quite a bit, and I still follow the Celtics, and so. It's just one of those things where, our Larry went back to Indiana where he's from. I went back to Minnesota where I was from, and he stayed there and has worked with the Pacers for so long. And I worked for the Timberwolves for a long time. Went down to Coast Houston, and now I'm doing the TNT and stuff. So it just your life just takes you to different places. And I think Danny's done a wonderful job. Danny's been great for the Celtics, and really, it's fun for me to have him there running the team. Whenever I want to talk basketball, whenever I want to talk Celtics, I call him up and we talk. And also, it really keeps me. I always cheer for him, but I have more incentive now with Danny as the GM and stuff to just watch the team more and be involved more. So when I come out I go over to the office and Danny and I sit around. We talk basketball. We talk draft choice. Talk a bunch of stuff.
Do you get the feeling when you watch them or you talking to Ainge the last couple of years, it does seem like he's done about as good a job as you can do building a team without a superstar player, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I like their team. They're scrappy. They're starting to get back to playing kind of the way they played more last year. But they had lost big guys, and then their offense, Brad Stevens' offense, needs those big guys to be able to make plays from the top, keep the ball moving, swing through them, and get from side to side, and keep that ball movement going. But I really like what their team has done. Little Isaiah Thomas has become just an unbelievable player for them, and just putting up phenomenal numbers. I just hope that somewhere along the line there can be one more move that Danny can do that can just kind of bring that guy in there and take all these really, really good pieces and turn them into that next level. I'd like to see them take one more jump where they can compete, with the Clevelands for that, Eastern Conference Championship, which isn't easy. Cleveland's a hell of a team, but they're not that far away, and he's done a great job, and he still has a lot of assets. He's still got the New Jersey pick, or excuse me, the Brooklyn pick.
Right.
He's got a lot of assets, so I do believe he's trying. The type players that he probably needs just don't come on the market all that much. But when they do, he's got to be ready to go.
I'm curious. You said you were friendly with Isaiah before that rivalry started. I'm sure you're friends with other guys. You see, and these guys all get knocked for it now. LeBron did in Miami and Durant did. Do you think if you had had that opportunity, say in 84 or 85, and the league was set up then like it is now, is there a chance you would have called Isaiah Thomas if you were a free agent or called some other star player in another city somewhere and say, hey, let's go to this city together and try and win the title?
Well, if you're playing on a terrible team.
Right, that's what I mean. Yeah, I mean, obviously you had won titles already, but.
Yeah, no, not when you're playing a good. Now, if you were on a franchise, then you just didn't see any hope.
That's what I mean, yeah.
If you think, boy, I'm not just going to be able to get it done here, I just don't think, that I need to play with another level of players to get a championship, or my team is just a level or two lower than what we need to be, and I don't see any help on the horizon. I could see people doing that. That wasn't even an option for us. But if you were on a really bad team, And, you know, and you were, you know, putting up big numbers and not winning. Well, who cares? I mean, yeah, that I never was really worried about numbers, you know, anyways. And that was just a different era now where numbers mean everything. But, yeah, that, you know, winning is the only really fun thing about the NBA. When you're winning, it's fantastic. You know, the games, you go out there, you compete. The winning is the ultimate goal, and that's just so enjoyable. If you're not winning, I can see why guys could do that. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you had a strange situation, and help walk me through this. So in the 80s, there was a year where you were a restricted free agent. The Knicks wanted to sign you, but Red put like about 40 poison pills in contracts with the Knicks. Isn't that right?
Yeah. It was the first time there was any kind of free agency, really. It was restricted. It was very different than it is now. And
it's like 84, maybe.
Pardon?
84, maybe.
It was 83, summer of 83.
Okay.
And going into the 83-84 season, and Larry Fleischer, who was the head of the Players Association, you know, had told me, "Well, boy, you know, if you use this system to change teams, it would be great. It'll start a whole ball rolling." And I'm like, "I don't want to go to New York. I'm
right.
playing Boston."
Right.
And so that thing started getting kind of all built up, and I really didn't. You know, I wanted to stay in Boston. Casey Jones had just been named the head coach, and I loved Casey, and he was just a great guy. And there was never. I did not want to leave, Boston. But I, you know, part of it was the new system up, and the guy said, "Hey, you got to talk to these teams." I mean, so I was kind of the guinea pig in this system, but at the end of the day, I think Larry knew. Fleischer, I told Larry, I said, "I'm not going. I'm staying in Boston now. We'll talk to some teams. We'll do some stuff just to, you know, to look at the system." It was very, very new back then. But no, at the end of the day, look, my heart was in Boston. I wanted to stay there.
What kind of having obviously around him for a long time? How would Red Auerbach do in today's NBA with star players, with the, you know, I mean, listen, players have changed. I mean, it's just George Karl talked about it. You've dealt with other guys have. I mean, players now, whether the egos are bigger or not, there are other things going on with social media. How would Red Auerbach today in 2016, now almost 17, do running a professional basketball team?
He'd do great. You know, Red was just straightforward, no BS. And that's the thing, is that, you know, Greg Popovich is you know,
that's true.
Like Red used to be. I mean, Red just told you the truth. And if you didn't like it, that's on you. And so he just challenged you. He wanted you to get better. He told you what he thought. What Red was able to do, and it started, you know, with his ability to get all those guys, you know, Russell and Cousy and, you know, the Jones boys and, you know, and Hawk Heinsohn and Hondo. He got all those guys to play together and buy in. Red had a great ability to put team first and explain it and get guys that wanted to be there, you know, team first guys and guys that would come off the bench and be a sixth man and not worry about it. And, you know, just winning was the only thing. And Red really just wanted to win. And that came across in him. Red would do fine in today's. You know, Red would be one of those guys that people would say, "Well, you know, he doesn't always tell me what I want to hear, but he tells me what he's thinking." And there's really no BS with Red, and his loyalty and his all of the things that made Red unique are still there. Still be there in today's game, and you would see it, and you would have no problem. I would have no problem if I was today's player playing for Red Auerbach, none whatsoever.
Obviously, the sports are different and their personalities are different, but Belichick reminds me of Auerbach in a lot of ways. You know that?
Yeah, I mean, Belichick's another guy like that. Just straightforward. This is what it is. I don't have an agenda. My agenda is to win the game. You may have a million different agendas, which is great for you, but when you come here, you got to be on my. You're on my time now, and my time is winning time. My time is, let's put all that silliness aside, and let's just get to this, and let's cut through this stuff. And if you're doing things I don't want you to do, I'm going to tell you, and it's going to be blunt. I'm not going to sit down in my office and then give you, "I'm so happy for you." I mean, you're going to get the real truth really fast. Then you're going to get up and you're going to have a decision to make. Are you going to be part of the team? Are you going to do what's right? Are you going to do what our culture says that you do, that we win? Or are you not? And if the answer is no, then you're going to be somewhere else. It's not really difficult.
Did
and
you have
Red got had that? Red had that down to a T.
Did you have guys who came in during the 80s? And obviously free agency wasn't as big back then. Did you have guys come in who just didn't fit into that mold, and then they were gone?
No, we had a very, very strong team, especially, you know, we came back from 3-1 in 81 against
right.
Philly and in the conference finals and won. And so that the nucleus of that team came in, and that team had a really, really strong personality. And whoever came in just kind of just really kind of fit in. And there was really never any issues about that stuff with players. It just was like I think the collective strength of that team and then their personality and all of their just kind of all how we were just overrode any one person that came in and tried to be disruptive. There wasn't, I mean, hey, if you're here, you're here to win. If you're here, this is how we're going to play. And if you don't, well, then you know, you're just not going to play. And everybody wanted to play back then, and so everybody bought in. But I, you know, going full circle, I don't see any problem with Red, you know, being involved in today's game and being ultra successful.
You have any regrets physically, or did it shorten your career playing in the playoffs in '87 with that broken foot, or no?
You know, no. I mean, it's, you know, it still bothers me a little bit to get the bad foot. Later on, I had really bad sprains, and you played on it, and you know, but that's just kind of what you did back then. I don't have any regrets. I think, you know, you like to think you'd be a lot smarter now, and there's, you know, the training techniques and the amount of staff and you know, how concerned they are about you as you know, physically wise, is completely different now than it was back then. But nah, I don't have any regrets. It's, you know, it is what it is. At the time, you know, if I had to do it over again, you told me that we had a great opportunity to win a championship in 1987, and I would have four championships instead of three, I'd do it again.
Do you miss the, you know, I go to some Celtics games and Bruins or whatever. I walk in the building, I still think of the old Garden every time I walk in there. I would imagine you must feel the same way.
Yeah, and there's no comparison between, you know, the old Garden and the new Garden. You know, for all the you know, the new millennials and everybody, I'm sure, you know, the new Garden is a fantastic place. You go there. But there was nothing like the old Garden. There was nothing like the old Garden. I mean, I went to a lot of Bruins games there. They're fun to watch. Of course, I played my whole career there. And it was just a cool old building. It had great, you know, the old organ player up there. No dancing girls, no nothing. But yet it had an unbelievable vibe during games. And it was really, really fun. You know, guys would, friends of mine would come from around the country, and they'd go to a game there, and they just would go like, wow, man, that's just a cool place to, you know, to watch a basketball game. And I'd say, yeah, it's phenomenal. So I mean, but I think the old, I feel the same way when I go in Chicago Stadium. It's nothing like the old Chicago Stadium. I walk in, you know, the old madhouse on Madison. You walk in the old one, that thing had all kinds of characters. This new one, they're all just big, very, you know, they look sanitized, big buildings. The other buildings had a lot of just a lot of character.
Do you want to coach again? I remember, you know, Bird talked about he wouldn't hire you. He said he had too much respect for you, which I thought was kind of odd, but I also understood it. Do you want to be a head coach again in the NBA, or you think you're done?
I don't. It would have to be almost just the perfect situation, and that doesn't really come up that often. You know, it's just a... it's a lot of work. You're dealing with a lot of different personalities. You're dealing with a lot of stuff. And to try to get to just the basic, what I talked about earlier, hey, look, this is how we do things. Winning is the most important thing. You're either in or out. That's hard to get on teams. I think with certain teams you have that. I think the guys on the Warriors, they go out and they play. And I kind of laughed earlier this summer when they were saying, well, boy, KD joined the team. There's going to be friction. And, you know, how many shots is Clay going to get? How many shots is Steph going to get? Like, you don't determine how many shots you get in August for a game in December. The game determines how many shots you get. You watch them play. The hot man gets the ball. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's why they're fun for me to watch. Same thing with the Celtics. The Celtics play a lot of players, you know, right now, and they get, you know, the ball finds the right guy, the ball moves and stuff. It's hard to get teams playing like that. And if you had a team like that, yes, it's fun. If you have a team where you're fighting them constantly to share with each other and play for each other, and, you know, that's not fun.
But TV is fun, right? I mean, I do some. It's just easier, right? You'd rather do TV than coach.
Yeah, TV is a lot easier, I promise you that. And the TNT and Turner people are fantastic. So I have a ball doing it, so I'm happy right now.
and Celtics Cavs tonight. And like you said, it seems to me with the Celtics team, I mean, I hate to say it, because the Spurs are playing well, we know that, but it does feel like we're on a collision course for Golden State Cleveland again. I do not see a scenario in which the Celtics team can beat this Cleveland team four times out of seven. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. I think the way they're currently constructed, I just think they need another really, really dynamic player that can make huge plays late, and, you know, a guy that can kind of carry the team a little bit, like LeBron is able to take Cleveland through a lot of different ups and downs in a game and keep them competitive and give them a chance to win late. But I really think that Boston's on that cusp. I think they can beat a Toronto team. I think they get to the finals, and then, you know, once you get to the conference finals, everything changes. But it'll be a great test. And when the season started, it just didn't look like the old Celtics team of last year. There was something missing. They seemed to have this, but, you know, they had some injuries, they had some guys out, but they didn't have that same vibe. Now you're starting to see it. You know, they can kind of get down and dirty. They can throw you, you know, Smart and Jay Crowder and Bradley out there across the, you know, 1, 2, and 3, and just hold and grab you and beat you up a little bit. They're faster to loose balls again. They're coming up with all the loose, scrappy stuff. Horford's fitting in. Olenek and Horford and some of those guys from the top can make plays and, you know, get guys off. Their depth of their team and kind of their strength in numbers, which they have in that team, is starting to show again. And that's how they have to play. If they play like that and keep playing this way, take this into the playoffs, they'll have a great chance to make a nice little playoff run. But again, just being truthful, excuse me, I just don't see them beating Cleveland. You know, I just think Cleveland's one level up.
Is Brad Stevens as good a coach as people say he is? Is the national people, is the local people? Everyone, you know, looks at him as one of the elite coaches in the NBA. He hasn't done a lot in the postseason yet, but would you put him right up there?
Yeah, I think Brad does a great job. I think Brad's first year, it was a huge move. You go from Butler, you know, come to Boston, it's end of game situations. There's a ton of stuff that you've got to kind of get your arms wrapped around if you're Brad, and it's a complete different game. And I liked a lot of stuff. I thought he grew tremendously from his first year to his second year. I really did. And I just think he's grown from there, and he keeps on getting better. And he runs some really interesting side out of bounds, baseline out of bounds stuff. I think he's very creative. And it seems to me that, he doesn't put himself above everybody. Like, you know, this is not the Brad Stevens show. It's the Boston Celtics show, and he's part of it. And he's got a lot of players on that bench, and you know he's trying to fit everybody into a rotation, and making sure that they play enough on a nightly basis to keep their rhythm. It's tough. I mean, he doesn't have an easy job. He's got a lot of guys that are very similar. A lot of guys that probably are very equal in their abilities. It's always easier when your team is formed. You got a superstar. You got a really good second player. You know, your third, fourth, fifth. It lines out like that. Everybody knows their role. But he's done a good job of just, you know, with this team, and I think he's a fantastic coach.
Do you think it's too complicated now? I mean, when you played in the '80s, you had, you know, two assistant coaches. Now you have, you know, five or six. You have a video guy. You have a director of operations. You have 50. I mean, has it gotten too complicated?
Well, you know, I think that the players are so specific in how they work out. I mean, you have I'm a coach for everybody. I mean, one coach handles maybe one or two players. Then you have the strength and conditioning guys. They're in there. They're your time when you come in. If you come in at, you know, 9 a.m. for an 11 a.m. practice, your time is filled up from, you know, strength and conditioning from 9 and stretching, and then the training table, just, you know, getting your body right. All the way up to 11, then practice from 11 to 12:30, 1 o'clock. Then after that, you have your shooting, you have your individual work. There's a lot of stuff that goes in that we did all that on our own. We put our own programs together as far as what we wanted to work on. We got our own workout partners. You know, we kind of did all they do today, but it was all, we all did it ourselves. Now they have so many people there for them that, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but the players just go from one person to telling them what to do to another person telling them what to do. And I don't think they have enough input. Like, if I was working with a guy and he said, we're going to work on this, and I never did that in the game, I look at him and go, why am I working on that? I don't do that.
Right.
Why don't I work on the things I do in the game? I'm never going to do that.
Right.
So why you know, and I see these guys have these really broad-based, development programs, and I'm like, why are we having that guy do that? Like, you know, that he's terrible at that. I got news for you. If you're terrible at something and you're 21, you're not going to be NBA ready to do that at 23.
Right.
If you're good at something at 21, you'll be NBA ready, you know, by in a year or two. But I see these broad-based programs. And back then, we all had our own program that, again, like I said, was really based towards what we needed to do to play in NBA games. And so I see a lot of they do so much stuff, and I see a lot of them wasted time. Like, you'll see a guy like Keith Smart will be in the weight room. Why in the world would he go in the weight room? That guy's strong. I mean, you might go in there to do some stretching and stuff. That guy, not Keith Smart, Marcus Smart.
Keith Smart.
Hell, I'm back in Indiana.
Indiana, yeah.
Marcus Smart, yeah.
Right.
Marcus Smart, excuse me. That guy's strong. Jay Crowder, those guys
big
need
guys,
very
yeah.
little. Those guys need very little weight room time. They just need to work. So like I said, you know, guys like that, you know, back then they'd say, well, I'm not going to lift. I'll stretch a little bit, but I don't have any problem. If you don't have a problem pushing people around to the floor, what the hell are you doing in the weight room? You know, you use basketball. So like I said, they're there for 5 or 6 hours. There's a million different people around them, pulling at them, pushing at them. And a lot of it is really, really good. A lot of it, I'm not sure, is just tailored for that guy to become the best NBA player that he can become. And I think when we went out, when we did it, we looked at it and we were honest and said, what do I got to work on? And that's the program you did. So it's different.
You know, I'll let you go with this. I know you got to run. But with when Bird retired, he said that the one game that he thinks about when he was at his peak was that game 6 against Houston, the clinching game in the 86 finals. I'd be curious if you had a game where you looked at it, if you said, listen, I could watch, if you wanted to watch Kevin McHale play one game, if you tell some kid, you know, here's Kevin McHale, when were you at your best? Do you have a game that you think of, you say, wow, I'll never be better than I was then?
No. I don't know if I could pinpoint one, but, you know, it was just for me, it was a process of just getting better all the time and working at my game and, you know, just came in as a rookie and just trying to learn the NBA, and you know, then by in a few years you kind of got the NBA down. You were in your peak physical. You weren't beat up with injuries and stuff like that. But no, you know, I mean, I think there were a lot of different periods where you know you stepped on the floor and you knew you were gonna. You know, you just had you were in a spot where mentally and physically and everything that you just knew you were gonna dominate the game and dominate the guy you're playing against, and that's really really fun when you walk out there with that. You know, man, I know I'm going to get the job done. I just you have supreme confidence that, you know, you're going to be able to, you know, handle all your assignments on that floor. You're going to be able to excel and do everything you want to do. Your team's going to win. It's going to be fun. And there's nothing like that feeling. That's just that supreme confidence. That just is a fun feeling. That's why we all played, and that's why my memories of Boston were so special, because I played with a bunch of guys that had that same mindset, and we won a lot of games.
And I think at your best, I think you were the best power forward ever. I know guys had longer careers, but your best, I think, you know, offensively, defensively, you were the best ever. And you can say for 10 days you held the Celtics single-game scoring record, so you did have that as well.
Got that going for me, exactly. All right, guys, I do have to run.
All right, Kevin.
Good talking to you guys. You take care, okay?
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay, sure. Bye-bye.
Thanks again for listening to the Enough About Me podcast. Actually, you know what? I'm really not thankful at all. You should be thanking me. You get this shit every week, these great podcasts, totally free. Do me a favor. Would you go to iTunes, download it, go to Stitcher, do the same, and leave a rating, leave a review. That's where you can help me out. This podcast is going to be number one again. I guarantee it. And you're going to help me along with the process. So for that, I guess at the end, maybe I will thank you. There's a lot of thank yous going back and forth. Here's the point. Fuck you.